Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about Francis Bacon, reading from the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. We're into episode 3, and when I last left you, we had been going on the fact, I don't know quite where the second episode, the title of the second episode went, but it's placing Bacon as walking away from Aristotelian, the main thrust of book-bound rhetorical thought, and replacing it with empirical thought. And the view that we've left this empirical thought, this causational thought, this argument, things do it because of their basic DNA or the quintessential properties of it. One of the things we came across is that he mentioned various Greeks, foreign people, and he mentions Roger Bacon. And who is Roger Bacon? And so I said, I'll check him out. Something very worthwhile checking out. And this is sort of stop press, someone who's more evilly treated than Galileo. So Roger Bacon is, wait for it, the inventor of the magnifying glass. So Galileo, after 300 years, put a series of magnifying glasses together to make a telescope. But he's the person who invented the magnifying glass. Well, he's a Franciscan friar in England, called Roger Bacon, for some reason. And at this time, friars, people, were not allowed to publish. So the Renaissance allowed people to publish, but then tried to censor what they published. So that's where Galileo would go wrong, and they used to be... Inquisition came along, there were these various things. People would stop your wagon and search your books and flick through every page of your book and see if you wrote notes on it. This is something more bizarre. This is where you're placed, and this particular person was placed under house arrest and not allowed to publish at all, not allowed to produce and write. And sort of vaguely known, so he's in the 12th century. Sorry, 13th century. So he's roughly 300, 400 years before Francis Bacon, or Roger Bacon. But he is sort of an experimental scientist. So what the heck there is? So we've got this view of that there were no experimental people. Now I have to look at it, and I'll have to really go back and do some research, what I can, of Roger Bacon. That's Francis Bacon and Roger Bacon. And Roger Bacon, as Francis Bacon, is the person who espoused and articulated it. Roger Bacon actually did experimental research back in the Middle Ages, and it almost makes my head hurt to think of it. I'll have to study it. So in as much that people nowadays use pretty dull, probably Aristotelian theory when they talk about commercialism, brands, and the logic and prejudice. Aristotle is just Aristotle is prejudging it. You know, things do it for a reason, that you can actually hold everything to account in Aristotle and in this modern world. And so I similarly had a pretty step-like function that, or transition function, that things were in the scholastic version and around Francis Bacon and various things, they just evolved slowly forward. But possibly taking a few hundred years from Aristotle to Faraday before Franklin. Well, Franklin was a thoroughly modern mind going around the place. This is Benjamin Franklin for you US people. But my understanding of history is wrong. There is these jewels sitting back in the Middle Ages. Roger Bacon sounds like this most fantastic person, because you read 8th century popes and there's just not a hope of anything logical ever coming out of it. You see people around the time of Nicolas de Casa beginning to work things out, but out of all this confusion, my knowledge of history is a bit step-like. So Roger Bacon really requires a lot of understanding. So it's the Thomas, but also the Epicureanism. There's actually three or four big regions of philosophical thought, and I think what people don't really pick up is on the Epicurean viewpoint, which has led into more biology than physics. Physics is basically underpinned modern biology, but the German biologists political philosophy is really based on Epicurus. So this Aristotle, the atomist, Democritus, which is more a theory of knowledge, and Epicurus is, and it's like Epicurean theory came into Leibniz as we go forward. So let's read third section from Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophers. Nature's philosophy, theory of idols, and the system of sciences. Now, this is a lot more, it's got a lot more feel for it to realize that Francis Bacon was in such a complex, weird world of Renaissance England, and there was Shakespeare around the place, and theatre and plays, and people would do things and be entertained by things. It's hard to actually understand the logistics of people going to see these plays and how they'd be put on and how they'd be financed. I don't know how it happens. 3.1, the idols. Bacon's doctrine of the idols not only represents a stage of history of theories of error, Brand, but also functions as an important theoretical element within the rise of modern empiricism. Gosh, and theories of idols is just fantastic. I love the spider and the bee. According to Bacon, the human mind is not a tabula rasa. Instead, it's an ideal plane for receiving image of the world in toto. It is, instead of an ideal plane of receiving the image in toto, it is a crooked mirror on account of its implicit distortions. What a beautiful thing. Now, the tabula rasa, and that's, I think, Leibniz, the black mind, because you can't have everyone with a black mind, because that would imply there were two people with exactly the same black mind, and that's impossible. Bizarre. He does not sketch a basic epistemology, but underlines that the images of our mind, right from the beginning, do not render an objective picture of true objects. Consequently, we have to improve our mind, free it from idols, before we can start the knowledge of acquisition. What a beautiful, beautiful view. As early as Temporis Par Masculis, Bacon warns the student of empirical science not to tackle the complexities of his subject without purging the mind of idols. Isn't that beautiful? That like an idol is a physical thing, you've got to get rid of it. Quote, "On waxen tablets you cannot write anything new until you rub out the old. With the mind, it is not so. There you cannot rub out the old until you have written the new. And that's true, and this is also true for me, finding out about Roger Bacon, but isn't that a beautiful thing? You cannot just blank your slate. You've got to install the new and then work out the old. And this is very much in my methodology, new science methodology of patterns and significance. At the end, you do a model of choice to review the old and rub out the old. What a beautiful thing of that. In the next paragraph, in Regardito Philosophiarum, Bacon reflects on this method, but he also criticizes prejudices and false opinions, especially in the system of circulation established by theologians, as an obstacle to the progress of science, together with any authoritarian stance on scholarly matters. And, I just can't agree with that more. Bacon deals with the idols in his second book, so The Advancement of Learning, where he discusses arts, intellectual, invention, judgment, memory, tradition. In his paragraph on judgments, he refers to proofs and demonstrations, especially inductions and invention. When he comes to Aristotle's treatments of syllogism, that is, Socrates is a man, therefore he'll be mortal, which doesn't actually prove into actually why Aristotle's going to stop breathing, Socrates is going to stop breathing. It's just, it's like a proof without ever really thinking about it. He reflects on the relation between sophisticated fallacies and idols are just amazing. Whereas induction, invention, and judgment presuppose the same action of mind, this is not true for the proof in the syllogism. Bacon prefers his own Interpretatio Naturalis, repudiating E.L. Elinches, I don't know what that means, as a mode of sophisticated juggling in order to persuade others of redargutations. I would say that a lot of people listening to people can't see that they're just crapping onto you. They're juggling. I love the word juggling. I think Aristotle's in a huge, great circular logic. There's no finding without proof, and no proof without finding. But this is not true of syllogism, which proof, syllogism, judgment of the consequent, and invention of the mean or middle term are distinct. The caution he suggests in relation to ambiguities in Enchiles, so Elenches, I don't know what that is, I'm going to have to read it up, is also recommended in the face of the idols. Quote. So the new, you've got to have right in the new state. There is yet a much more important and profound kind of fallacies in the mind of man, which I cannot find observed or inquired at all, and think good to be placed here, as well that which of all other apparenteth most to rectify judgment. There, the force whereof is such, as it doth not dazzle nor snare the understanding in some particulars, but doth more generally and inwardly reflect the corrupt state thereof. For a mind of a man is far from the nature of a clear and equal glass, wherein the beams of things should reflect according to their true incidence. Nay, it is rather like an enchanted glass, full of superposition and imposture, if it cannot be delivered and reduced. For this purpose, let us consider false appearances that are imposed upon us by the general nature of the mind. It's almost Shakespeare. I mean, you've got to listen to it many more times, and it's really beautiful. But it's not like a pair of binoculars, where it enhances something and produces a true image. It is really thoroughly corrupt. I love the way that he said that. Bacon still presents a similar line of argument to his reader in 1623, namely, in De Arguments. Judgment by syllogism presupposes, in a mode agreeable to human mind, meditated proof, which, unlike in induction, does not start from a sense of primary objects. In order to control the workings of the mind, syllogistic judgment refers to a fixed frame of reference or principles of knowledge as the basis of, quote, all varieties of disputations. Well, yeah. Okay. The reduction of propositions to principles leads to the middle term. That's got so much to refer. What does the middle term mean? Bacon deals here with the art of judgment in order to assign a systematic position to idols. Within his art, this art, he distinguishes between the analytic form of detection of fallacies, sophistical syllogisms, analytical works with true forms of consequences and arguments, which become faulty by variation and deflection. The complete doctrine of the detection of fallacies, according to Bacon, contains three sentences. Let's just stop for a moment and try and work out what this person is. Syllogisms are really bad. They're really illogical, but syllogistic law is the actual way that society is built. So I own something only, it's not analytically proven, it's only ultimately syllogistically proved. A road rule is a syllogism. You are a car, this is a road, I'm a policeman, you're booked. Bucko. Okay, you can argue with a policeman, do you really exist? Okay, there are three segments. Sophistical fallacies, fallacies of interpretations, false appearance or idols. Concerning one, which is sophistical fallacies, which is a sophist means philosophical fallacies, I suppose. Aristotle, for his excellent handling of matter, but also mentions Plato Honorable. Fallacies, so this is just, say, I would say the New South Wales curriculum. Yes, this is the book we do it. Fallacies of interpretation refer to adventurous conditions of, or adjunct of essences, similar to the predicaments open to physiological or logical inquiry. He focuses his attention on the logical handling when he writes the detection of fallacies with interpretation to the wrong use of common and general knowledge, which leads to sophism. Which I think maybe just generally a false interpretation, like the moon is travelling around the earth, the actual, you're still, but the earth is moving. I still don't quite understand that. Fallacies of interpretation refer to, quote, adventurous conditions or adjunct of essences, similar to the predicaments open to physical or logical inquiries. He focuses his attention on logical handling when he relates his detection of fallacies of interpretation to the wrong use of common general knowledge, which leads to sophism, that is, philosophies. That's really hurting my head to even read that. What does that mean? I'll have to get back to you when I fully understand it. But at least I'm having a go at fully understanding. Other people just say, oh, Francis Bacon, I think some people say he invented gunpowder and was responsible for the gunpowder plot. I heard one teacher say, just amazing. I could laugh. Okay. In the last section, Bacon finds a place for his idols when he refers to the detection of false appearances as the deepest fallacies of the mind. They do not deceive in particulars as others do by clouding or snaring the judgment, but by a corrupt and ill-ordered predisposition of the mind, which, as it were, perverts and infects all anticipations of the intellect. So I think we in Australia might call them a wanker. That may be a definition of a wanker, I'm not sure. Idols also produce human imagination caused by crooked mirrors of the mind, and thus are nothing more than untested generalities. Wow, this is heavy going stuff. Hopefully I'll be able to go through it and give you a simple version of the idols. Hopefully you'll go through it. So, but the idols appeared as the third layer down. So this is, I think going through. Number one is book learning or adhering to a particular brand of thought. Number two is genuine misinterpretation from being taught incorrectly. And number three is adherence or the wrong setting of your mind. Now let's see if this is correct. In his preface, Nova Organum, Bacon promises the introduction of a new method which will restore the senses to their former rank, begin the whole labor of the mind again, and open two sources and two distributions of learning, consisting of a method of cultivating the science and another of discovering them. These new beginnings predisposes the discovery of natural obstacles to efficient scientific analysis, namely, seeing through the idols so the mind's function is the subject of knowledge acquisition and comes into focus. According to Aphorism 23 of the first book, Bacon makes a distinction between idols of the human mind and ideas of the divine mind, whereas the former are for him nothing more than certain empty dogmas. The latter show true signatures and marks set upon the works of creation as they are found in nature. Wow, let's try and read that one out. So there's mistakes that you can make, but there's also great social mistakes. But let's go to the idol of the mind. So this is a bit heavy going. So he's got three layers. This is... I'm just trying to work out what the three layers are. Now, the first layer is just being set up in the wrong camp. The other is honest mistakes that you can make, misconceptions you can make, and there's mistakes, internal mistakes. So let's do the idol of the tribe. And these are beautiful things. Beautiful things. The idol of the tribes have their origins in the production of false concepts due to human nature, because the structure of human understanding is like a crooked mirror which causes distorted reflections. And so that's 3.1.1, idol of the tribe. It's not explained very well. The idols of the cave consist of conceptions or doctrines which are clear to the individual who cherishes them without possessing any evidence for the truth. These idols are due to preconditioned system of every individual, comprising education, custom, accidental or contingent experiences. So, and this is what you may, as an infant, just believe that glass is a force field, or ice comes from a fridge or something. I don't quite know. The idol of cave, being in a cave. Idol of being in a tribe. Let's read the idol of the tribe again. The idol of the tribe have their origin in the production of false concepts due to human nature, because the structure of human understanding is like a crooked mirror which causes distorted reflections of things in the external world beyond. Idols of the marketplace is based on the false conceptions which are derived from public human communication. They enter our minds quietly by a combination of words and names, so it comes to pass that not only does reason govern words, but words act on our understanding. The idol of the theatre, which is the most one, I'll have to go back and study this and summarise it again. According to the insight that the world is a stage, adults and theatres are prejudices stemming from received or traditional philosophical systems. The systems resemble plays insofar as they render fictional worlds which were never exposed to experimental check, or to a test by experience. The idols of the theatre thus have their origin in dogmatic philosophy or the wrong laws of demonstration. So you think this is like the politics in an organisation would be the idols of the theatre. So really I have to go back. There are four idols, and I thought the idols were much more thing, but they list the nature of it. Beckham ends his representation of idols in Nova Aurigium, Book 1, with the remark that men should abjure and renounce the qualities of idols, and the understanding must be thoroughly freed from cleansed. He discussed the idols together with the problem of information gained through the senses, which must be correct by the use of experiments. That's interesting. So he's got three level structures, and at the lower level he's got four structures there. And just to read again, the idols are... Tribe, cave, marketplace, theatre. Marketplace is social. Theatre is social stuff. Cave is innate. Tribe, I don't quite understand. It's probably to be read much more thoroughly than this. The cave, the marketplace, and the theatre. And the theatre is an entire play, or an organisational play, because you say you might be in a particular army, the army is doing something, it's trained your way, so that's the theatre. Yeah, well, I'm trying to read it to you, explain it to you, and this is best as I can do. He discusses the idol together with the problem of information gained through the senses, which must be corrected by the use of experiments. So this is the fundamental use that the experiment... It's interesting that experiment is a teaching. Experiments are teaching, which has got significance there. It's just, I would say, in my way of significance, the experiment has a personal significance. System of sciences. Within the history of Occidental philosophy and science, Bacon identifies only three revolutions in the period of learning. The head over the Greeks and the Romans in the Western Empire, and Western Europe in its own time. Okay, so there are three periods. Number one is the Greeks, number two is the Romans, and number three is his own time. This meager result stimulated his ambition to establish a new system of sciences. This tendency can be seen in his early manuscripts, but it's also apparent in his first major book, The Advancement of Learning. In this work, Bacon represents a systematic survey of the extent realms of knowledge, combined with meticulous descriptions of deficiencies, leading to a new classification of knowledge. In The Advancement, a new function is given to the philosophical primary, the necessity of which is indicated in the Nova Organum. I don't know. In both texts, this function is attributed to the philosopher naturalist, the base of his concept of the unity of the sciences, and thus of materialism. Well, this is the natural philosophy. Natural science is divided by Bacon into physics and metaphysics. A former investigates variable of particular and particular causes, the latter reflects on the general and constant ones for which the term form is used. Form is the second Aristotelian cause. I don't know what he means by it. Forms are more general than the four Aristotelian causes. Oh, God. And this is why Bacon's discussion of forms of substances as the most general properties of matter is the last step of the human mind when investigating nature. Metaphysics is distinct from philosophical primer, and I suppose quintessential essence. The latter marks the position in a system where general categories of general theory of science are treated as 1, universal categories of thought, and 2, relevant to all disciplines. Final causes are discredited as they lead to difficulties in science and tempt us. Yeah, this is to amalgamate theological and teleological points of doctrine. Now, again, I'll have to go back and read out what teleological. Theological is God, teleological is system of knowledge doctrine. At the summit of Bacon's pyramid of knowledge are the laws of nature, the most general principles. At the base of the pyramid starts with observation, moves on to invariant relation, and then to more inclusive correlations until it reaches the stage of forms. The process of generalization ascends from natural history via physics towards metaphysics, whereas accidental correlations and relations are limited by the method of exclusion. It must be emphasized that metaphysics has a special meaning for Bacon. This concept, 1, excludes the infinity of individual experiences by generalization with a theological focus, system of knowledge focus, and 2, opens our minds to generate more possibilities of efficient application of general laws. So this is basic science. I don't know whether we have a direct pyramid at the moment. We have these basic principles, but as science, I will have to go through and read this more. 3.3. Matter, theory, and cosmology. According to Bacon, man would be able to explain all processes in nature if he could acquire full insight into the hidden structure and the secret workings of matter. Bacon's conception of structure of nature, functioning according to its own working method, concentrates on the question of how natural order is produced, namely by the interplay of matter and motion. Their principles and equity originibilis, his materialistic stance with thus regard to his conception of the natural laws becomes evidence. The summary of laws of nature is a vicious matter come motion or power in accordance with matter theory or, quote, the force implanted by God in these first practices form the multiplication thereof of all the variety of things preceded and is made up. Wow, I hope you can take that. That's my brain is just not taking any of this in at the moment. Or it is, certain things, but I'll have to go back and really punch it in. I suppose the issue for me is that none of this is a little bit outside what we can profitably use and process. It's really difficult. And we've moved on, but it's the real deal. This is the real origin of it. Okay, similarly, in De Sapienta Veritatem, the wisdom of truth, I suppose, he attributes to this force, and so what force is this? Force of nature, okay, an appetite for instinct or primal matter, or to speak more plainly, the natural motion of the atom, which is indeed the original and unique force that constitutes and fashions all things out of matter. Gosh. That's a bit of a shock. So we've got people who do not believe in atoms at all. This is Descartes, Leibniz, and all this type of stuff. Let me reread that again. Which is indeed the original and unique force that constitutes all fashions, all things out of matter. This is the atom. Suffice it to say here that Bacon, who did not reject mathematics and science, was influenced by the early mathematical version of chemistry developed in the 16th century. So the term instinct must be seen as a key word of his theory of nature. The natural philosopher is urged to inquire into the appetites and inclinations of things by which all that variety of effects and changes that we see in the works of nature and art are brought about. Wow, that's, and it's interesting that they use appetite and is used so much here. Bacon's theory of active or even vivid force in matter accounts for what he calls Cupid in what De Pretis Aequas Originibus. Since his theory of matter aims at an explanation of reality which is substratum of appearance, he digs deeper than the mechanistic physics of the 17th century. Bacon's ideas concerning quid facti of reality presuppose this distinction. Quote, between understanding how things are made up and of what they consist, and by what force and in what manner they came together, and how they are transformed. In all his work, where it becomes obvious that he tries to develop an explanatory pattern in which his theory of matter and thus his atomists are related in his cosmology, magic, it's related to his cosmology, magic and alchemy. Gosh, so this is the big breaking news that, in terms of atom supporters, you've got, obviously, Boltzmann, you've got Dalton, and you've got Bacon. Bacon, you can't get away from him. In this argument, Bacon not only refers to Pam and his nymphs in order to illustrate permanently atomic movements in matter, but in addition revised the idea of magic in the honourable meaning as what? Pan and his nymph, what? Oh, this is amazing. The knowledge of the universal contents of things, I understand magic as the science which applies the knowledge of hidden forms to the production of wonderful operations, and by uniting, as they say, active passes displays the wonderful working of nature. Oh, this is complicated. He doesn't believe in magic. Bacon's notion of forms is made possible by the integration of matter into theory, which ideally reduces the world appearances to some minimal parts accessible to open manipulation by the knower maker. Okay, so that just knowing that these guys have no complex numbers, no algebraic understanding. In contrast with Aristotle, Bacon's knowing why type of definition points towards the formation of efficient knowing how type. In this sense, a convergence between the scope of definition and that of causation takes place according to the constructivist epistemology. The fundamental research of Graham Rees has shown that Bacon's special mode of cosmology is deeply influenced by magic and the semi-Parsalian document, the doctrine. So what is, what, this is it, because it's one of these things that you can either go in a short way or a long way. So, I've got to get out a simple thing. Mate, do you believe in magic? I think he does. For Bacon, matter theory is a basic doctrine, not classical mechanics as with Galileo. Consequently, Bacon's purified and modified versions of chemistry, alchemy, and physiology remain primary disciplines for his explanation of the world. So, I have to work out how Bacon and Aristotle go. According to Rees, an author. The Instru Magna comprises of two branches. One, Bacon's famous scientific method, and two, his semi-Parsilian world system as a vast comprehensive system of speculative physics. For this latest system, Bacon conjoins his specific version of Parsilianism, cosmic chemistry, to Islamic celestial kinematics. What is an Islamic celestial kinematics? The chemical world system is used to support Bacon's explanation of celestial model notion in the face of contemporary astronomical problems. Thus, the two sections in Bacon's Instauratum, which imply the modes of their own explanation. And this is, I think, this getting around the great supernova of the 1600s, where a star, a fixed star, just blows up. And Bacon's speculative cosmology and matter theory had been planned to constitute part 5 of the Instrata Magna. The theory put forward refers to an eclectic vein of atomism, criticizes Aristotelian and Copernicans, but also touches on Galileo, Paracelsus, William Gilbert, Tesla, and Arabic astronomy. This is just absolutely crazy. So he's at the time of Galileo, doesn't believe it. William Gilbert is the discovery of magnetism and electric field, is Queen Elizabeth's doctor. For Bacon, magic is classified as applied science, which he generally subsumes under science, pure science and technology. He is never identified with black magic, since it represents the ultimate legitimate power over nature, whereas magia is connected with to the crafts. In the 16th and 17th century, Bacon's science remains the knowledge of forms in order to transform them into operations. Knowledge in this context, however, is no longer exclusively based on formal proof. Bacon's cosmological system, a result of thought experiments and speculations, but not proven in accordance with the inductive method, presupposes an infinite universe, a geocentric plenum, which means that the Earth is passive and consists of tangible matter, where remaining universe is composed of pneumatic matter. Wow. Whereas the interior and tangible matter of Earth is covered by a crust, which separates it from the pneumatic heaven, the zone between Earth and the middle region of the air allows the mixture of pneumatic and tangible matter, which is the origin of organic and non-organic phenomena. Bacon speaks here of, quote, attached spirits, while otherwise he assumes four kinds of free spirits: the air, terrestrial fire, which he refers as the sublunary room, ether, and sidereal fire, which are relevant to the celestial realm. He's whack. Ether is explained as the medium in which planets move around the central Earth. Air and ether, as well as water in non-inflammable bodies, belong to Bacon's first group of substances, or the Mercury Quaternaria. Whoa. Oh. So he's really just flipped out mad. Terrestrial fire is presented as a weak variant of sidereal fire. It joins with oily substances and sulfur, for all of which Bacon introduces the sulfur criterion. So he's got, he's got mercury and sulfur. This quaternus comprises of antithetical qualities, air and ether versus fire and sidereal fire. The struggle between these qualities is determined by the distance from the earth as to the absolute centre of the world system. Air and ether become progressively weaker as these terrestrial and sidereal fire grow stronger. The quaternion theory functions as Bacon's thought as a constructive element for constituting his own theory of planetary movement and the general theory of physics. This theory differs only from other contemporary approaches, even though Bacon states that, quote, many theories of the heaven may be supposed which agree well enough with the phenomena and yet differ with each other. The diurnal motion of the world system, the ninth sphere, is driven by sympathy. It carries the heavens westward around the earth. The sidereal fire is powerful, and according to the sidereal motion is swift, the stars complete their revolution in 24 hours. Since the sidereal fire becomes weaker if it burns nearer the earth, the lower planets move more slowly and unevenly than the higher ones. This way, Bacon, like Apollodorus, accounts for the irregular planetary movement without reference to Ptolemy's epicycles theory. So it's actually a third theory. Here you've got geocentric with Ptolemy's epicycles, but Bacon's got another theory for it. What the heck is it? That's really interesting. He applies his theories of consensual motion to physics generally, wind and tides, and thus comes in conflict with Gilbert's doctrine of interstellar vacuum. What? Gilbert, interstellar vacuum, which is correct. And Galileo's theory of tides, for Bacon, the cycles of tides depend on diurnal motion of the heavens, but for Galileo, it's on the earth's motion. With the quaternion theory, so we've got mercury and sulfur so far, we see that in the final analysis, Bacon is not a mechanistic philosopher. His theory of matter underwent an important transformation, moving in the direction of forms which could nowadays sublime under biology and life sciences rather than under physics. Bacon distinguishes between non-spiritual matter and spiritual matter, the latter he called subtle matter. Or spirit. This is interesting what Leibniz would say, the latter also, subtle matter or spirit, is more reminiscent of Leibniz's monads, which is, that's crazy view. I mean, monads are so hard to understand. So a monad is a particle, an abstract particle of philosophy, knowledge, that, then of the mechanically defined and material as well as spatially determined atoms. Spirits are seen as active agents of phenomena. They are endowed with appetition and perception, which is similar to Leibniz. Historia Vita Mortis, of life and death, Sylvia Samarium, the century 9, quote, it's certain that all bodies whatsoever, though they have no sense, yet they have perceptions. For when one body is applied to another, there is a kind of election to embrace that which is agreeable, and to exclude or expel that which is ingrate. These spirits are never at rest. In the Nova Organum, and then Bacon rejects, quote, the existence of external and immutable atoms and the reality of the void. His new conception of matter was therefore close to that of chemists, in the sense that Bacon's semi-Parcellian cosmology, a careful natural philosopher, tries to disclose secrets of nature step by step, and therefore he says of his method, quote, I suppose, to establish progressive stages of certainty. This points towards his inductive procedure and his methods of tables, which is a complicated mode of induction by exclusion. It is necessarily because nature hides her secrets. In Aphorism 19 of Book 1, in his Nova Organum, Bacon writes, quote, "There are and can only be two ways of searching into and discovering truth. The one flies from the senses and particular to the most general axioms and from the principles, the truth of which takes for the settlement and the immovable proceeds to judgment and to the discovery of the middle axioms. And this way is now in fashion. The other way derives axioms from the senses and particulars, rising by gradual unbroken ascent, so that it arrives at the most general axioms last of all. This is the true way, but yet as untried." So this is experiments. This, I think, is experimental science, getting the big theory of everything. The laws of nature, which Bacon intended to discover by means of his new method, were expressed as forms in which the unbroken ascent accumulates. Though these forms, the natural philosopher understands the general causes of phenomena. In his endeavour to learn more about the secret workings of nature, Bacon became to the conclusion that the Thomist theory could not prove sufficient explanation for real particles such as they really exist, because he thought of the immutability of matter and the void, both necessary assumptions of atomists, were unattainable. His language turned from that of the Greek physics to the usage of contemporary chemists. This is due to his insight that, quote, subtlety of investigation is needed, since our senses are too gross for the complexity of the fineness of nature, so the method has to compensate for the shortcomings of our direct comprehension. Only method leads to knowledge of nature. In Silvarium, Bacon deals explicitly with the question of asymmetrical relationship between man's natural instruments, the senses, and the intricacy of nature's structures and workings, which is really interesting because we now, scientists, believe you can see things with a microscope. Bacon distinguishes animate or vital spirits, which are continuous and composed of substances similar to fire, and lifeless and inert substances, which are cut off and resemble air. The spirits interact with the gross matter through chemical processes. These spirits have two different desires, self-modification and attraction of like spirits, according to Cargan. Quote, Bacon's later theory of matter is one of interaction of gross, visible parts of matter and visible material spirits, both of which are physically mixed. Spirits interact with matter by means of concoction, co-liquidation, and other non-mechanical chemical processes. So Bacon's specific paradigm differs from Descartes' mechanist theory of matter in Descartes' Principia Philosophia, which presupposes res extranta, moving in space. Bacon's theory of matter is thus closely related to his speculative philosophy. Quote, "The distinction between tangible and pneumatic matter is the hinge on the entire speculative system turns. Paracelsus had already stated that knowledge inheres in an object. Bacon's theory of matter, in its final version, is more corpuscular than atomists. Bacon's particles are semi-rem. They are endowed with powers which make a variety of motions possible and allow production of all possible forms. These spirits are constitutive of Bacon's theory of matter. As material, fine substances composed of particles combine in the form of fire, air, and fire. They can, as well you have seen, be either inert or animate. Bacon suggests a corpuscular and chemical chain of being. Inert objects go to inorganic spirits. Vegetables is inert plus vital spirits. Animals is just vital spirits. What the heck does that mean? Small reminder then that Bacon's spirits are indispensable for its conception of physiology. Quote from Bacon, the vital spirits regulate all vegetative functions of plants and animals. Organs responsible for these functions, for digestion and assimilation, seem to act by perception, mere reaction to local stimuli, but the reactions are coordinated by vital spirit. These functions flow from the spirit's airy, flamy constitution. The spirit has the softness of air to receive the impressions and the vigor of fire to propagate its actions. The philosophical stratum of Bacon's natural philosophy was influenced by the semi-Parcellian cosmology, and which Graham Rees has reconstructed from the parts of the Andromeda. Detailed considerations, therefore, has to be given to Bacon's theory of quaternions. We've only got two quaternions so far, and that's mercury and sulfur. Bacon's speculative system is a hybrid based on different sources which provided to him with similar ideas. Atomism, Aristotelism, astronomy, Copernican theory, Galileo's discoveries, and the works of Parsis and Gilbert. Now, Gilbert's a great man. In his theory, he combines astronomy referring to Apollotargus, Rees and Upton. It's partly designed to fit a kinematic skeleton and explain, in general terms, the irregularities of planetary motion as a consequence of chemical constitution of the universe. Bacon had no explanation of the planetary retrogressions and saw the universe as the finite geocentric plenum in which the Earth consists of two forms of matter, tangible and pneumatic. The Earth has a tangible inside and is in touch with the surrounding universe, but through an intermediate zone. The zone exists between the Earth's crust and the pure pneumatic heavens. It reaches some miles into the crust and some miles into the air. In this zone, pneumatic matter mixes with tangible matter, thus producing attached spirits, which must be distinguished from free spirits outside the tangible bodies. Bacon's four kinds of free spirits are relevant for this quaternary theory. So he has air, the ether, sublunary, and celestial. He has air and celestial fire, sublunary, and ether and sidereal fire for celestial sphere. So he's got a mix of Aristotle and fires. The planets move around the Earth in the ether, a tenuous kind of air which belongs to the Mercury quaternion. It includes watery bodies and mercury. Terrestrial fire is weakened from sidereal fire. It's related to the oil substances of sulfur and constitutes sulfur quaternion. The two quaternions oppose each other. Air, ether, fire, sidereal fire. Air and ether lose power when terrestrial and sidereal fires grow more energetic. Bacon, sulfur and mercury are not principles in the sense of Paracelsus, but similarly natural substances. The Paracelsian principle of salt is excluded by Bacon, and the substance which plays a role only on the sublunary realm is for him a compound of natural sulfur and mercury. I'll take a break now. I've been reading for over an hour. There's still a lot to go through. So this is sort of an element of brilliance in terms of realizing that there's flaws in logic, but and experimental techniques, but does he actually apply it? There's just so much information to account for and explain, sort of the hygiene factors in terms of things that you basically have to explain, like the motion of stars, etc., and chemical elements. And he doesn't have any scientific experiments yet, but he's living in the time of Galileo, and a whole series of things are coming in which are really challenging. So you can see the church sort of said yes or no. He's been thrown off into the deep darkness, trying to actually work out how things are going. What's interesting is that nowadays, if someone came up with this, we'd just say he's a crank, go away. But he had nothing to stop him, so he just continued to write things down, and there's some brilliant ideas. It's just to pick up some sort of things to do. What I picked up is the experimentalist as seen as a bee as opposed to a spider, beautiful thing, and the idols basically is, you know, your prejudice. The thing I sort of like is that the mind is not like a slate. You can't clean it, you can't wipe it clean and put something new on it. You can only you have to write on top of the old stuff before you can actually wipe it clean. It's actually quite a brilliant saying. He may be against, well, he actually says, look, I can't explain things except by magic, and we may put them down, but a lot of people in their belief of companies and technology is, their view of technology is akin to the view of magic at this time. I'll come and read some soon later. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.